What is up, everybody? Just to give you a heads up, this episode has been edited from its original version. The original version contains some content that we gained some new information on. Some of the facts have come to light. The location of where the original content took place was also wrong in the original episode. So we want to make sure we're not putting out fake news or anything like that. So we did our due diligence to remove that information, get more of the story, and we will be releasing it on the very next episode. We appreciate you guys all sticking with us. Apologize for any inconvenience. Now, here is the original content minus that portion of the episode.
You know what it takes to make a shot at that range? Everything comes into play that far. Humidity, elevation, temperature, wind, spin drift. This is a 6 to 10 second flight time, so you have to shoot it where the target's going to be. Even the Coriolis effect, the spin of the earth, comes into play.
Marines, be advised. And I mean nasty and tired. I eat concertina wire and piss napalm. And I can put a round through a flea's ass at 200 meters.
870 yards in closing. Wind, 3/4 value, push 2 left.
I can just shoot women, children!
Easy! You just don't need them so much!
This is my rifle, this is my gun, this is for fun, and this is for fun.
Hey everybody, Tyler here for the Sub MOA podcast. We appreciate you guys joining us for today's episode. Enjoy. Good evening, everybody, or good night. This is Tyler. It's July 13th. It's a Monday. Jeremy, I got you on the hook with me again, dude. And
what's up, guys?
Yeah, you just got back from Utah.
Yep, sure did.
We got some cool things to talk about. I've been, you know, I spent my weekend only shooting one day, right? But I got some stuff to chat about. And I think for some people, it will raise some questions. And I think other people are just going to get pissed off.
Awesome. That's what we're here for.
We like controversy, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, before we jump into it, pretty good drive up to, Utah or up to Colorado?
Yeah, man, it was long, but smooth, uneventful. I rode up to the match with Eric Severson. We left super early Friday morning. It was a 10-hour straight shot all the way up there. And then we decided to drive the 10-hour straight Sunday night after the match. And that might not have been the smartest decision because I was really fucking tired by the time we got home. But we made it. We didn't crash. No tickets, no citations, no traffic stops, none of that. So it all worked out.
Well, you have one of those don't pull me over badges on your car, don't you?
Absolutely not, man.
Damn.
Absolutely not. They don't work. Little hint, guys. Those license plate frames, nobody cares about those. So.
Wait a minute. You mean the little sticker that says you donated to the police association doesn't keep you from getting a ticket?
Yes, that is correct.
Son of a bitch. All right. All right. Well, I mean, before we get into Colorado, I will tell you, you did not miss anything here. I went to Arizona on Saturday. I was here on Sunday, here in Las Vegas. And both locations, it was hell on earth. I can't even tell you.
I heard it was a little warm.
A little?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was 114 degrees outside. It was
warm. Oh, buddy.
It was rough, dude. Like, by the time that monthly match ended, and I didn't even know it was a regional qualifier, but by the time that thing ended, and we're standing around waiting for the results. You know how like all the iPads got to sync and shit like that?
Yep. Yep.
Well, it's like fucking noon and the sun is straight up over you. So, I mean, at this point, I'm trying to like crawl under certain cars to find shade. I mean,
yeah, there's no protection up there.
Dude, it was rough. But, anyways, we're going to talk about your time up in
Colorado at the Mile High Shootout, and it's all going to kind of tie together, right? Because the first thing I want to talk about is your match. And the reason I want to bring this up is you did really well. If people follow you on Instagram, they probably saw, or Facebook, that you took third place overall, right?
Yep, sure did.
You know, if you guys don't follow Jeremy, it's at Jeremy Ty on Instagram, Jeremy Ty on Facebook. But the reason that this is significant is not just because, like, oh, hey, awesome job, Jeremy, right? But, you know, a lot of the times we learn the biggest lessons from failure, right? You do something wrong.
Oh, I agree.
You know, you do something wrong, or you do something that causes pain, and your body remembers that, or your psyche remembers, like, you know, that feeling, and it programs you to not make that mistake again. But at the same time, when you do things well, right, when you break into that top three for the first time, or, you know, whatever the case is, I think it's important that looking back, you try to analyze what was different. Was it the match? Was it the way that you prepared for it? Was, you know, was there, did you get more sleep? Did you, I don't know, like, you know, lately I've been taking melatonin to try to sleep better at nighttime. Like, you know, there's certain things that you got to look back, not just when you do bad, but also when you do good, so that you can repeat those same things to try and continue this performance. And, you know, so a lot of times when I try to analyze, you know, how was my performance this time? Oh, it was good. It was bad. You know, what are the things I need to improve on? I always look at the things that I did well, or, you know, what was it last year? I won the Steel Safari, and I spent a lot of time analyzing, why did I do so well? Right. Was it just the luck of the draw? You know, because I don't want it to be luck. I want it to be purposeful. And I feel that because you got that third place under your belt now in this national level match, that we can analyze this win together and kind of share with all the listeners, like, some of the things that felt right, or, you know, maybe you were thinking differently. So that's kind of what I want to dive into right now. And what we're going to spin off of that is talking a little bit about the National Rifle League, some things that I've heard and found out, some assumptions that we're going to place bets on.
But, okay. I'm in.
That's the controversial part, right? And, you know, I think to start off, we're going to talk about your match. And then I'll tell you some things I heard about Colorado, some things I heard about last year, and, you know, just some stuff that needs to be brought up. Because I don't like there to be this, you know, this, let's compare it to the United States, right? You have the actual government, and then you have, you know, depending on how, what's the right word here, conspiracy theorist you are, then you have the
deep state. You have the deep state.
Right? Okay.
Yep.
Well, from things that I'm hearing, you have the NRL that everybody sees, and then you have the deep NRL. So, So we'll talk about that.
Well, I'm intrigued.
Let's talk about your match, dude, because it's 2 days that requires you to be on your fucking game, and you did pretty fucking good. So, outside of Rusty spanking all your asses, because I saw his score, he was on the money, it looks like.
That guy shot his ass off, man. Yeah, he destroyed everybody.
That's what
he didn't have a single stage, and I don't know if there was a stage that he shot where he dropped more than 1 point. He laid it on. So the day one scores were a little deceiving, because it turns out, like, one of Rusty's stages did not make it in to the day one totals. So he should have been at the top after day one.
See, that's
it. And obviously he won on day two. But, you know, like, it looks like there was a huge jump between his day one and day two scores. And he shot well day two, but, you know, he had like 10 extra points on day one that didn't get accounted for. So he was in the lead the entire time, and nobody had a shot. He laid it on everyone.
It looked like a pretty epic performance for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the best I've seen him shoot.
So we'll start with the beginning. You drove up to Colorado on a Friday or Thursday.
Yep. So we went up Friday. I went up with Severson. I can't remember if I said it or not. Eric Severson and I drove up Friday. And we got out of here a little bit later than we had planned on. So by the time we got to Colorado, there really wasn't much time to do anything at the range. Now, I had not planned on zeroing or chronoing anyways, because I'm an idiot, and I only had 270 of the 115 DTACs left. And when Robert put out the match announcement, he's like, hey, match total is going to be 256 or something like that, but bring 300 just to be safe. Well, that left me with 14 rounds to play with. So I just said, screw it. I zeroed and chronoed down here in Las Vegas, and then said, I will just, you know, I'm going to roll the dice up in Colorado. I didn't think it would make that much of a difference, and it turns out that it didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got up there Friday, checked in, went to the hotel. You know, we had some dinner, but we went to sleep. We didn't go out and do any – we weren't involved in any pre-match shenanigans. Let me just put it that way.
Oh, so you were being a professional.
Yes. Yes. Which I usually do, man. I'm not big into partying or drinking or any of that stuff. Saturday, day one, the weather was actually really good. It was sunny. I don't know. I think we touched 100. There was definitely some wind out there, but it was pretty consistent, and direction of fire was pretty much the same for 10 out of the 12 stages. So if you had a general idea of what was going on one stage, you had a pretty good idea of what was going to happen on the next stage.
Okay.
Where did we start? We started, so let's see, it was 22 stages. We shot 12 on Saturday and then 10 on Sunday. And man, the big difference for me, because I had 10 hours to think about this on the way home, the big difference for me between this match and all of my previous matches, number one, I paid attention to the wind. And what I mean by that is I was on the glass all the time. And I was still joking around. I was having a good time with my squad, like squad four, you guys are awesome. I had a great time with you. Except for a little poop, man. We got to work on those camera skills. But other than that, man, it was great. We were joking and smoking, and you know, everybody was friendly and getting along with one another. But at the same time, like, I was there to do work, you know. So I was on my binos a lot, and I didn't pay attention to what other people were saying about the wind, and that was probably the biggest factor for me. When I look at how I shot this weekend versus how I have traditionally shot in the past, I trusted myself. You know, you hear new shooters or even experienced shooters, you know, they're always asking, hey man, what was your wind call? What was your wind call? What did you do here? What did you do there? And yeah, you know, that sometimes can be important, but more often than not, whatever, you know, the shooter in front of you's wind call was, is not what it's going to be for you. So,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, like it was so hard for me to get away from trusting other people's information, and then instead of that, like trusting myself. But I was on glass all the time, man. We were catching really good trace, checking mirage, you know, close to midway, and then all the way out to the target, taking into account. Like, have you shot the Colorado match before?
I shot it last year.
Okay. Yes. So, I mean, you know, we shot in the same spot, and you know, like there will be targets, you know, all the way across the valley with a ridge line in between, and what the wind is doing on this side of the ridge is not what it's doing on that side of the ridge. And when you get up, you know, to the upper wind levels, it's kicking a lot harder. And it just seems like I was taking all of that stuff into account for my own personal wind calls. And, you know, I'm not perfect. I will never be perfect at calling the wind, but I was pretty close most of the time.
Yeah.
And when I would have, you know, a first round miss, I was able to spot my miss. I was able to track the trace and go, okay, it's going a little bit faster there. you know, make a follow-up shot, get that impact, and then roll from there by adding that correction into the rest of my win calls for the other targets. So that was the biggest thing. I trusted myself. It's easy to listen to people talk about wind, and it's easy to know what you should take into consideration in order to make a good wind call, but it's hard to take that knowledge and apply it in the field. And I seemed to apply it in the field pretty well this weekend.
You're not the only person to say this. You know, the first NRL match of the season was rifles only, and the winner of that match was Chris Way.
Yep.
As soon as that match was over, Chris called me. He's like, dude, I listened to your podcast about wind calling, and that's all I did. The entire match, I was on glass watching Mirage, watching how the dirt moves, how people miss. I made all my wind calls. I didn't listen to shit from anybody else. And, you know, like, that's how it works, man. So that's awesome for you. And once you take that step, and I'm sure you're kind of feeling the same way now, like once you take that step where you stop listening to other people, maybe you listen to what they say, but it doesn't influence you to the point where you're holding the exact same thing that they did. All it does is confirm or strengthen or make you question what your starting wind call is going to be, you know?
Exactly. Yep.
But you're not using what other people gave you. And I preach this all the time. Like, you just have no idea how somebody zeroed, you know?
Yep.
You don't know if their body alignment was off when they zeroed. You don't know anything. So this person could be shooting. You just ask what their wind call is, but lo and behold, you know, their zero's off by like 0.2 mils one direction or the other. And you can't figure out why their wind calls are this and yours are that, you know, like, so I think that's one of the most difficult things. But now that you've kind of, I don't want to say like crossed the threshold, but more or less like kind of built a little bit more faith in your ability, I think it's going to change your game, man.
Yeah. I'm a lot more confident now than I was prior to this weekend. This weekend was, you know, it validated a lot of stuff for me.
Yeah.
Number one was my ability to trust what I'm seeing in the glass, and not only through the binos prior to shooting, but also through the glass while I'm on the gun. There was one stage in particular. I only ended up with 6 out of 9 points on this stage, but this was like the most important stage in the match for me, I think. The wind switched directions on me 3 times. Holy, it started out going right. So the way the stage worked was there was three like 2/3 ipsix up on the ridge line. You started out going from far to near, target 3, target 2, target 1, and then going back near to far, 1, 2, 3, and then you switched position. And then you re-engaged either 1, 2, 3 or 3, 2, 1. And I can't remember, but on that second engagement, you had to, it was like hit to move on, or you had 2 shots to make 1 hit or something like that. But so I started, you know, with the array the first time, 3, 2, 1, and the wind was going right to left. And I missed, I think I missed 2 shots there. And then as I was coming back, you know, like I actually parallaxed in a little bit, saw that the Mirage had switched and went the other way. So I adjusted and then held for a left to right wind, and I made 2 out of 3 impacts. Switched to the second shooting position and then re-engaged that array again, but I parallaxed in and saw that the Mirage had changed yet again. So it was back to a right to left, and I went 1 for 1 on every target there. So I only got 6 out of the 9 points possible, which wasn't very impressive if you just looked at the score. But the fact that I was able to see that the wind had changed not only once but twice, and I made corrections for it both times and got impacts both times after that correction, like, that was, hold on, I just unplugged it. You there?
Yep.
All right, my headset popped out, sorry about that. But to be able to see that wind change through the optic on the timer while you're shooting, from a not super stable position on top of a log, managing a tripod, to be able to do all of that stuff and do it successfully was a big deal for me.
I think it sounds great, man. And kind of what it tells me is, you know, the biggest thing when you're shooting a stage or if you're on a hunt, whatever the case is, like when you have a target or you're on the clock and you have a timer, it makes you rush. It makes you go. It makes you want to go fast, right? Fast. Gotta beat the clock. Gotta beat the clock. You know.
Yep.
You know. Oh my gosh, this elk is gonna move. I gotta hurry. But people who slow down and take their time are the people that will see those changes. You know, if you're just trying to get your shots off, right? You're not playing a game of what's the wind doing anymore. You're playing a game of correction. So if I miss, I'll make a correction. But if you slow down and you take your time and value a hit more than beating the clock, then you're going to see those changes. And it sounds like you were just on it this weekend, dude. So, and it's important. It's important to recognize those types of things because, you know, it's the next step. You know,
it
push you to that next level. And, you know, so it's, I feel like it's super important that you realize as a shooter, the things that you do well, right? Or the things that led to how you got to where you got, you know, or you won't be able to repeat it.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. I think the next big match for me is going to be the Northern Arizona one. I believe that's at the end of September. So I've got, you know, I've got about a month and a half to let all of these lessons marinate in my head, you know, and then get prepped for that next big one. But so in addition to the wind stuff, the wind thing I think was the biggest factor for me. Mm-hmm. But also, I used one bag for this match. I take that back. I did borrow a positional like pump pillow for a couple stages because I didn't even bring one. I brought the Tricor, man. That's the only bag I had.
Nice.
And it's pretty much the only bag I used. I used it in the front and I used it in the back. And you guys have not been to the Colorado match. It's a pretty even split between shooting off of barricades, whether man-made or natural terrain barricades, and then prone. But when I say prone, you're probably picturing in your head a pretty level shooting surface with targets that are also like in a level plane in comparison to the rifle. And that is 100% not the case what happens in Colorado. Usually the rifle, if you laid the rifle down on a bag and did not run the legs all the way out on your tripod and suck that tripod in towards the rear of the action, you weren't going to be able to see the targets because the ground that you were laying on was angled down and the targets are across the valley on the face of the hill above your elevation. So you have got to jack that gun way high and your body position is all screwed up behind the rifle. There was no like conventional zeroing prone position at this match. It was all fucked up.
Yeah, I remember it from last year, and I don't know where I saw it. I saw it, maybe you posted it or somebody else posted it, but somebody had mentioned like there was a minute of angle stage. It might have been Russ.
Yep, that was here.
My team partner. So they had that same stage last year, and I don't know how it went this year, but some of the MOA targets were in like sage fields.
So, yeah, they were the same. I don't think the targets moved this year.
All right. So
it was the same array as last year.
You know, like 300, 400, and 500. If you missed those targets, good luck.
Yeah, you didn't see shit.
If you didn't see where your trace went, you were not seeing an impact. You know, I thought it was interesting to see that stage again, but, I mean, I saw a few posts from people like Andy had posted up some kind of like big metal structure he was shooting off of. It looked like he was using the long bipods to shoot from
there. Oh, in the front, and he was using the structure as the rear support?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that photo. So, yeah, that was like stage 21 or something. When I saw that photo, I was like, man, that's an interesting way of shooting it. I wonder how it worked out for him. I ended up just putting the tricorn in the front and running the tripod in the rear.
So as soon as I saw that picture, I was like, you know what? I wonder, you know, I know Andy. Andy's a good dude. He wouldn't, you know, try and game outside of the rules or anything like that. So I'm imagining that the rules were pretty lenient.
So I have the matchbook in front of me right now, and I will read out the stage description.
Because I saw his picture, and I'm like, man, not everybody could do that. So I'm wondering how other people shot it. So now I hear you shot it with a front support and a tripod in the rear, and you shot it with front bipods and a buttstock on the support beam. You know, like, there's tons of different ways to engage in that moment.
What stage was that, man? I don't remember which one that was now. Oh, that's right. So it wasn't 21. It would have been 11. Sorry, there was some numbering stuff going on.
It's all good.
So stage 12. So that was the last stand. So here's the stage description, guys. Shooter will begin mag in, bolt back, port arms. Upon engage command, shooter will move to the first position on the barricade and engage targets near to far with one shot each, hit or miss. Shooter will then transition to the next shooting position to the right of the barricade and engage targets far to near with one shot each, 10 hit or miss. So 10 rounds, 10 points. Targets were 45% IP-6 at 360, 450, and then 66% IP-6 at 580 and 640. And a full-size IP-6 at 790. So that was the stage description, word for word. There were no gear restrictions at the match. And it had initially been put out that all gear had to be deployed on the clock, but there were a couple stages where, for whatever reason, that was not the case, and ROs were allowing you to start with, you know, like, bipods deployed, tripods deployed, all of that stuff.
Okay.
Pretty sure that stage was one of the ones where you could start with the tripod deployed already. And I'm assuming that he started with his bipod deployed. But that was it. There was no, you know, the stage description didn't specify that the front of the rifle had to be supported by the barricade or any of that stuff. It just says, you know, first position on the barricade. And there was paint marks on it. You had to be within the left and right paint mark limits.
Okay.
That's it. Go to town.
So stages like that, you know, kind of leave it open to creativity and, you know, what gear do you have? What gear is at your disposal to help you outperform other people, right?
Yep.
And, I think it's cool. You know, I like seeing different ways people come up with how to attack a stage instead of just seeing everybody run it the same way, you know, especially if there's different options out there. I get some stages, everybody's going to run it the same way because that's just the best way to do it. But, you know, when you have a stage like this, that's so generic. It's like, shoot from here and then shoot from here. And you're like, okay, how can I do this the best? I love those stages, you know? So, but yeah, I saw his photo and it instantly made me think like that must have been a pretty chill stage when it came to the rules, because not everybody had that capability that he had with his bipod system.
Yep. So, no, it was pretty open, man. There basically it said like, hey, here are your targets, here are your shooting positions, you have to be within this area and go to town. And that was for most stages. You know, they would have for any of the stages where you were shooting prone, they would just have a stake nailed into the ground, and the rule was you had to be within arm's length of the stake. You could be left side, right side, front of it, behind it, didn't matter. Somewhere in this area, you do you.
You feel like this match was a, what's the right word for it? This match was a gear race? Like,
No. This match was a shooter race.
Okay.
There was nothing, the targets weren't tricky. There was no, all the ranges in the book were on, like you could have shown up without a laser and been fine. There was glass available at every stage for you to look through. And the state, like the props that you shot off, they were simple. You know, what makes this match difficult is the wind. Yep. And then the target size is pretty small. And like we talked about just a minute ago on that MOA stage, a lot of these targets are up off the ground in the sagebrush. Yeah. And if you don't get an impact, you're not going to see anything. The bullets disappear. So if you're not able to catch your trace in flight, good luck.
Did they have that target where the outside edge was a separate piece of steel from the inside?
No, they didn't.
Oh, thank God.
And in fact, I think Quigley gave that to Eric because he wanted that for his range in California. But no, there was nothing like that. There were the only stage where that had like two pieces of steel on one hanger were the two hostage targets, and you had to shoot the little, you know, circle to the left or right of that hostage head. Everything else was super straightforward. But no, I'm sorry, man. We kind of went off on a tangent there. To answer your question, this was not a gear race match. You needed a bipod and a bag, and that was it.
I was kind of figuring that because I know Rusty, and Rusty's good dude, but you know he's a very straightforward, simple dude, and I just him tearing it up as well as he did. I can imagine him out there with just a rifle, a bag, and a bipod, and just being in the zone, man. So, yeah, I just want to get your take on it, if you thought it was like a gear race or if there was any specific gear that might have helped you more.
Nope. I mean, so, you know that big-ass Coltac bag that I have? I didn't take it with me this year because I intentionally am trying to slim down all of the shit that I carry. I took, like I said, I took the tricorn and that was it.
Yeah.
If I would have taken that big bag, there was one or two stages that I probably would have used it on. But I didn't have it. I didn't use it. I made do without it. I still shot pretty well.
Okay.
So no, it was.
What would you say from this match? We've talked about what you did well and things that kind of like light bulb, like, bam, holy shit, this is working, right? But then to completely flip the script, I always ask myself, I always ask my students, what is going forward? What's the one thing that you took away from this match that you're like, I need to improve on this? Like, improving on this would have improved my score. Can you pull anything from this match and say, this is what I need to work on?
Man, honestly, this was by far the best that I've shot. So I'm still kind of on cloud nine right now. No, dude, like my stuff was on point.
Okay.
I had one, so I'm looking at the scores here. There was one stage that I shot that I was not pleased with myself, and it was the troop line stage.
Okay, yeah.
It was the same stuff from last year, or the same targets, you know, those six diamonds out there. Let me see, that was stage six. This was one of the far stages. So for all the listeners, I'm going to read you guys a stage brief. It was stage six, shooter will begin mag in, bolt back, in position on the ground. The RO will identify which target you are to engage. Once the RO indicates the target number, the timer will begin and the shooter will have 25 seconds to locate and engage the target with two shots.
I do remember.
And then there's going to be an on deck and an in the hole shooter. And those guys need to be ready to go when the current shooter is finished. And round count 12, max points 12. So the targets, they were all 16-inch diamonds, and they were between 916 and 1,060 yards.
Yep.
Now, last year, I think like the RO came behind you and gave you a number, and you just engaged that one target, and then they moved to the next shooter.
Correct.
This year, you shot at all six targets. Without any interruption. So she would call out a number, you know, target three, acquire target three, put the dope on, send a round, see what happens, send another round. And the minute you sent that second round, the RO would immediately call another target. And so it was just, you know, it was one continuous string of fire. And I fucking hate diamonds. I don't know what it is about diamonds. Yeah. They kicked my ass. But I ended up with a 2 out of 12, and that was the second stage of day one. And I was doubting my shit after that because I didn't zero on Friday and I didn't chrono on Friday. Now I did it Thursday here in Las Vegas, and I put three rounds in the same hole, and I put the chrono on, and I shot three rounds, and I was 29.98 with like an SD of 4. So I was like, okay, this is it. Like, let's go. And I didn't think that going from Las Vegas to Colorado would affect anything too much, but that second stage on Saturday, which is one of the long ones, and my results were not what I had hoped. You know, I started questioning my year. So my confidence was a little lacking. It turns out it was me. It was not the gun, because for the rest of the day, my shit was on point.
Yeah.
You know, looking back, I probably should have been a little mentally stronger after that stage, but you know, I ended up pulling it out. So it all worked out in the end. But looking back now, all of my misses were like 2/10 low. And if the targets would have been squares, I think I would have had many more impacts. They would have just been low on the target. My wind calls weren't shitty, but you know, like, not only do you need a good wind call, but your elevation has to be on point. And the minute you start shading one way or the other on either of those calls, your target area, the target becomes smaller, right?
Oh yeah.
So, you know, like, I tanked that stage.
I feel you, man.
But that was it, man. 22 stages. I only had one bad one. That was it. The other ones, you know, like, I was pleased with my performance. I dropped a couple shots here and there. Like, you know, I broke a dirty shot and I knew that it was going to miss the minute I broke it. Like, man, why the fuck did I do that? But, you know, traditionally I'll have 15 good stages and I'll have 5 really shitty stages. In this match, I had 21 good ones and one bad one. That was, you know, the difference.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm looking at the NRL website right now. And with this match, you're going to jump up quite a bit. You've only got one match on the actual national level points race.
Yeah, I shot Utah last month. I was supposed to shoot Idaho, you know, got canceled. Fuck you, Corona. Yeah. I was supposed to shoot Wyoming. It got canceled. Fuck you, Corona, you know. So it's not like I have been avoiding shooting. I've had matches on the books. They just haven't happened. So
yeah.
Next one will be Utah. Then we'll shoot Regina's match in November. Then I will go back and shoot Idaho and Wyoming next year. But
well, I think now that you've got your second match in there, you're going to jump up into somewhere probably in the top 25, I believe.
Oh, shoot, man. Shoot.
You're going to get an invite to the championship come April.
Well, that's always my goal, man. That's what I want.
Yeah, I think
I just want to go there and participate. You know, I'm not planning on winning the championship. I just want to go and experience it.
Wait a minute. I was planning on you winning the championship.
Is that what we're wagering on?
Kind of. So, talk about the match. You know, we'll talk about Arizona. That one day match. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Kind of sticking with the NRL theme, right? Now, this is where we're going to transition to that. Some of those controversial things. First topic is I heard that there were some RO issues at this match as well.
That's news to me, man. I didn't hear anything like that. Every stage had a dedicated RO.
Mm-hmm.
The ROs seemed to be on point. They knew what the stage was. Their instruction / direction at the stage brief was clear and concise. I didn't see anybody getting bullied around. I didn't No, I have zero idea what you're talking about, man. I didn't hear anything. I didn't see anything. I thought the ROs were fantastic. There were a couple times when an RO had to go from the iPad to paper scoring because it was 100 degrees on Saturday.
Yeah.
And there's no shade out there.
Oh, yeah.
And there were, we had pop-up tents getting blown over and being destroyed. So we were in the sun all day, so the iPads were overheating.
Mm-hmm.
So I know some ROs had to switch to paper, but other than that, I don't have any idea about any RO drama.
Oh, it wasn't really drama. It was more or less there was a lack of the appropriate amount of ROs is what I was hearing. So I don't know how.
Well, maybe my perspective is a little jaded because having shot the Utah match where there were no fucking ROs, coming to the Colorado match where there was an RO on every stage.
Yeah.
Was awesome.
Yeah.
It was just one. I don't know. There might've been two stages where there were two ROs. But it was still we're going to spot and call impacts. They made sure that there was at least two people on glass. And usually the RO also had a set of binos or a spotter, for themselves, but we were the one calling out impacts most of the time.
Okay.
But no, man, I didn't.
Well,
I have zero complaints about how the RO or how the match was, ran or, how the ROs interacted with the shooters. No, it was great.
Yeah. Well, at least having one RO at every stage is better than self ROing,
100%. 100%.
So the, go ahead.
I think that's going to be the norm. From here on out, moving forward, it's hard for match directors to find ROs. That seems to be a common theme. So I think the days of having two and even three ROs per stage are long gone. From here on out, it's going to be one RO, and then you guys are going to self-spot for each other, which I'm fine with. As long as there is some sort of match representative at each stage to ensure that there is no fuckery or inconsistency from squad to squad.
Yeah. Well, I know that, there's still a lot of development happening, in terms of how to make sure these national level matches get run the right way. There's no question, all of those things. Just kind of reiterating what I've heard and then kind of confirming with you, see multiple sides of the story. And I still got to talk to Russ and see what he says. But, so one thing I heard was that there were not necessarily stages without ROs, but there were just a limited number. So, be that as it may, I still think we're going to have to get to the point where people are getting paid to come RO. You're only going to get the same people ROing every single match so often. People want to shoot, So
I agree. There's going to need to be some sort of compensation. Yep. I forget who I was talking to, but I was having a discussion with an RO about that. And, he's like, hey, I called up. I was going to go down and RO this match. And I asked the MD, where are you putting us up at? And the MD said, no, you're covering your own hotel. And the RO was like, well, forget that. Not only am I going to give up my weekend to come down and help you, but you are going to force me to pay for my own hotel. That makes zero sense. So I'm not coming down to help you anymore.
You get a 50% off certificate from US Optics.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's cool. But if I really want one of those, I can go to Sniper's Hide and just buy one for $100. And that's a whole lot cheaper than investing a 3-day weekend away from my family on the road, out in the heat, listening to a bunch of shooters.
I'm with you. I have not put together a national level match. I'm actually looking into it right now. But, I'm a guy who likes to go above and beyond, right? So if I do a national level match, it has to be motherfucking epic. So I don't know. We'll see. Maybe 2021 will have something in store. But just, you know, for running the one-day matches down at my place, you know, I know what expenses I have. And, you know, I know what it, you know, I know where this money goes. And to look at a national level match, I don't know how many shooters were, at this match?
106, 107 maybe. I don't know. Let's pull up the scores. Cause so there were some no shows.
And the entry fee was $250, right?
It might've been a little bit more than that.
All right. So at a minimum, we're looking at $25,000 brought in. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good number to use.
25 grand. Again, this is not me trying to bash any match directors or anything like that, but there's $25,000 being brought in, right? At a minimum. If the match costs more, or if you have to charge each shooter an additional $25 to cover lodging or food or to do something to offset the cost for ROs, then it needs to be done.
Like, oh, I agree 100%. I think we talked about this, didn't we? I would pay more. I would pay $50 more match to ensure that there were good quality ROs on every stage.
100%, man. Right. So you've got on one end, you've got the match director, right? That should be looking at how do I ensure that my match runs smooth, that I have quality ROs that come in, they get compensated for their time, for their effort, you know, shit like that. And then on the other hand, what about the league itself? You know, like, I guess I kind of look at like football, you know, I watch a lot of football in the fall. You have sports teams that compete against each other on every Saturday and Sunday, right? And you have referees. Those referees ain't working for free, right?
Hell no.
Fuck no, they ain't, right? Now, in Little League, they are, but this isn't supposed to be Little League. This is supposed to be national level rifle competition. So the referees, the ROs, you know, these people, just like the NFL, the National Football League, is paying those referees. I feel like the NRL should be doing something to help these match directors, right? So that they're not getting in, put into a position like they are right now where they're struggling to find people. And some of these places that are out in the middle of nowhere are going to have a harder time finding ROs than places that are near more populated areas. Like, you know, let's talk about the NorCal event, right? Not only is NorCal really well run, but it's a pretty populated area. So people who don't get to shoot are also going to get to help RO, right? But, you know, so I think lower populous areas are going to need some assistance. And I just want to, I bring it up because I feel like it's going to get more and more of an issue if we don't start looking at a solution. So
I agree, man. I agree 100%. The RO thing needs to be addressed.
Yeah. And like I said, $25,000 being brought in, I don't know where the money's going. I'm not saying the money's not being well spent. All I am saying is maybe you should consider, you know, charging a little more to ensure that the matches run smooth and well and, you know, things of that nature. Now, there was another thing I was talking about with another shooter talking about, you know, high-profile shooters who – lose their cool or can bully ROs or whatever the case is, right? We know that there's shooters out there that have that influence to do those types of things, right?
Yep.
I was thinking if a match director has less control over scores and there's more of a board of like a match scoreboard or a scoreboard board of directors, right? So every match has a certain amount of ROs that are experienced. And at the end of the match, you are supposed to have an arbitration period. I was telling this individual same thing because he had asked me, he's like, you know, if you have a scoring issue, what do you do? I'm like, well, for me, like, I try to keep my matchbook pretty squared away with what I shot on each stage and which targets I missed, so that I have a pretty detailed record. So if there is an issue, then I have some kind of evidence to stand on instead of just going and saying my score is wrong, right? Like, you got to have something to back it up. But, you know, so if you have an arbitration period, you need a method of showing your shit, saying this is what my score should be, right? Now, there's been times in the past where it's not been many times. I think I can count two or three times where I was like, man, I think my score is wrong. One of them was Arizona at Regina's match. And they're like, hey, this is arbitration period. So I went up there. I'm like, hey, Regina, I think I got an issue with my score. We looked at it, and it turns out I had two stages mixed up, right? I had once, you know, stage eight had stage nine score and stage nine had stage eight score and whatever. I was wrong, right? There's not been many times where I've been right, especially when we're using practice score. You know, it seems to be pretty straightforward, but it doesn't mean mistakes can't be made. So arbitration period, and then you have a board of score keepers, right? So I don't know, like, does having multiple people involved, like 3 to 5 people who have to unanimously agree, like, yes, this score should be changed, does that help with this issue?
I mean, I don't think that's necessary, man. I think that practice score logs every keystroke, right? And I use that term. I know it's not a keystroke, right? But every input gets logged.
Yeah, even
every input is reviewable.
Yeah.
You can download and you can go in and see every change that was made in that match.
Yeah. Now,
to more directly to your point, you shoot a stage, you get a 6 out of 10. You come back to the RO. The RO says, hey, shooter, I've got you for 6 points. The minute you hit that approve button on the pad, and it says 6. That's the end of it. There should be no need for arbitration. You are given an opportunity to review your score before it is put into the program. If the score is wrong, that's on you. Now, if there's an issue there on the stage, the RO has you for 6, but you think you had 7. And somebody else on another set of glass thinks that you had 7 also. Well, you know, like, that's when you get on the radio. MD, come over here. We got an issue. Like, let's get this settled out. And then it's squashed right then and there.
Oh, I completely agree with that.
But all of this stuff afterwards about going in and editing scores, like, that's inefficient.
I don't
know. I get it. Like, the shooter comes off the line and, hey, the RO says, hey, shooter, blah, 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 blah. I've got you for 6. Okay, thanks, hit approve, you know, and doesn't ever take a look at the iPad. Well, guess what, bro? That's also on you. Stop being lazy. Go verify your score and then move on with your match.
I am in agreement with you, but
that's just me.
Let me give you a scenario from Montana. I shot the Montana match, right?
Yep.
I didn't keep a single score. I didn't write anything. I gave my matchbook away. We talked about this, right? So I did not keep my score whatsoever. But other people were keeping my score for me. So I guess they wanted to know how I shot more than I did. And when the scores first came out, there was an arbitration period, right? And I looked at my score. I'm like, my score is correct, right? So there's nothing that I could do. But other people saw a discrepancy, right? There were 2 stages. The stages didn't get thrown out, but what did happen was a target broke. So instead of dropping the entire stage, they just cut that target off of the stage, right? But for half of the shooters, the target did not get deleted from their iPad. So when the scores got uploaded, there were some scores that were wrong. And some people were honest enough to come forward and say, I have 4 more points than I should have during the arbitration period. So they went, they fixed it, and then scores got released, and then everything was great. So in regards to that, right, I still think there's certain situations, depending on how that match is run, where you might need an arbitration period, or everybody needs to be notified that, hey, a stage was dropped or a target was cut out, or something like that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's not something I'd ever that I've thought about before.
So, but I also agree with you. Like, you know, if you're waiting to the end of the match for arbitration to come forward and say, no, I hit 8 on this and they only gave me a 6. Well, why wasn't that addressed on the stage at that moment? So I agree with you there. You know, I feel like both things apply. You need to address your issue right there on the spot. You should be looking at the iPad. You should be hitting approve, or at least looking at the iPad before you tell the RO that you approve. Match director should be telling everybody if there were changes to any stages so that shooters can notate that. And then there should be a arbitration period for reasons like I just discussed. But, you know, big ticket changes should not be happening. But, you know, so I don't know. Even though they implemented this rule last year where you have to look at your iPad, you have to hit approve, there still seems to be issues when it comes to individual scores not lining up. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, so there we had that at the Colorado match, right? Because Rusty was missing a stage after day one. But that circumstance, I think, was a little out of the norm because the iPads were not functioning due to the heat. So they were going to paper and his just got missed. So, you know, there again, that would be another situation where arbitration, you know, is useful.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, you as a shooter, you need to keep track of your own score. And if there's an issue, you need to catch that immediately. And if you don't, that's also on you.
Yeah.
Too bad.
I agree. So only reason I bring that up is that there were, this is hearsay, so I don't even want to say the guy's name because it was like secondhand knowledge to me. But one shooter, and it wouldn't have changed his placing at all. One shooter apparently was missing like 3 points or something like that. But it didn't matter because it wouldn't have changed his placing, nothing like that. So I don't know. I don't know if that was a single isolated event. I don't know if that was multiple people. But
is that you're talking about the Colorado match or the one you showed?
Yeah, from Colorado. So I don't know. That's what I mean. Like, you know, there's so many different things happening there. You know, I feel like to be a professional organization definitely needs to be some more hard rules written or at least enforced, you know, like you're talking about. Look at that damn iPad before you walk away from the stage, before you hit approve, you know. So I don't know, man. I just, things that I hear, I feel like I should bring them up. Kind of spinning off of this, we talk about a national level match that I want to put together, and I'm trying to find the right venue for it right now, but I want to keep it here in the Southwest. I don't want to go anywhere crazy. I want to keep it here in the Southwest. And you were a dude, you know what, outside of like rifle shooting, I'm pretty ignorant when it comes to like IDPA, USPA, stuff like that. But talking with JJ Ricaza and some of these other, you know, pistol shooters, some of their events, you know, their award ceremony is, you know, go to your hotel, clean up, and, you know, put on some nice clothes and get to this banquet hall. Have you been through something like that?
Yeah. I mean, I shot the Nationals for USPSA a couple times.
So that's kind of what I'm looking at right now is I want to change the game a little bit. I want to establish a national level match. I don't know if it'll have any affiliation. And you know, at this point, I really wouldn't care if it did or not. Like, I just want it to be a good match that encompasses quite a bunch of different skills, you know. And at the end, I want you to have time to get cleaned up, to go put on a nice shirt, you know, come to the banquet hall, have a professional, you know, announcement where we have, you know, different sponsors represented. We have a good dinner, you know, things like that. Like, this is going to be game changing if I can put it together. And it's only because I'm just a cracked out perfectionist who likes to do things above. But I don't know. I feel like if Pistol can do it, then why can't Rifle do it? So,
well, I mean, there have been instances where Rifle has done it. I mean, I've seen it happen.
Yeah.
I think the concern, you know, for the NRL matches that I've gone to is the MDs want to get the shooters out, because a lot of the shooters are traveling immediately after the match, right? So, hey guys, match is over at 3. Let's be down at the banquet location at 3:30. We're going to eat. We're going to get the scores out. And then you guys that are leaving town, safe travels for everybody else that's staying. Like, let's go get our drink on type deal.
Yeah.
So, I just want to put out there, like, we're not throwing shade at any MD because –
no, definitely.
You know, like, we didn't have time to go home and clean up at the hotel, because I appreciate, you know, being able to just get the hell out of there so I don't lose another day off.
100%.
You know, Monday.
And that's where this kind of takes some planning, right? Because you want to make sure that you account for those things. People getting out of there early, getting time to travel, stuff like that. But I also want to make it worth their while. You know, if I get to put this match on, I promise you, there's not going to be any profit in it for me, because I'm going to spend every dollar making sure that the banquet hall is set up before we even get done shooting, that the dinners and lunches are on point, that, you know, the trophies are the level that they need to be. They're cash payouts. Like, I want this to be the most badass event that we could put together in the Southwest to have a good time, you know? So, anyways, it kind of pushes me to think about Arizona this weekend, because that one day match that I did at Cowtown with the Long Range Precision Rifle Club,
yep,
Gina and Tim and then Matt, all those guys, dude, some of the stages, they capitalized on every strength or weakness that you could have, right? So, for example, I think stage one, shoot strong hand, shoot weak side, right? Or, you know, support hand, whatever you want to call it. And then you roll into stage two, and here you are, you're shooting unsupported seated, right? Now, we do this at Sin City sometimes, and it's not a bad stage, right? But typically, what's the size of the target?
Oh, it's generally a full-size IPSC at, you know, 300 or 400 yards, like something that's pretty easily doable.
All right, so this was a 325-yard target and a 490-yard target. And it was I don't want to get the dimensions wrong. I think it might have been a 12-inch square or a 15-inch square at 390, and then a turkey at 490. Square at 325, turkey at 490. It was pretty brutal, dude.
Nice. And
the top score was a 5 out of 10 rounds. And, I mean, that thing ate my lunch. I need to do more bicep curls or something, because, you know.
Yeah, take some weight off the gun.
20-pound rifle, man. You're sitting there like, and you're in the seated position. And it's still like, holy shit, you know. So.
I like that. I like hearing that.
Dude, it was awesome. It was a good stage, you know. One of those stages where it's like, this is a clear-cut weakness, right? Now, on my side, they allowed you to use a sling and a glove. I brought neither, so you just got to rough it and go with the flow. Then you had another stage where they had this Home Depot clamp. You know, you could squeeze it and it clamps onto something.
Yep.
And they had a little red plastic bin. So they clamped this bin at top of your head level, and you put all your 10 rounds in there. Start down in the prone. Beeper goes off, you jump up, grab around, hop down, shoot this target at like 3 something, and just up, down, right? It's like, I think it was called the burpee stage. So now they're testing your physical fitness, I would say. Like, how fast can you get up, get down, but also what is your, what's your breathing going to be like as you continue to do this? You know, are you in cool enough condition to perform this motion without it affecting your shooting? I mean, it was a giant ass bowling pin at 300 yards. So I saw people miss. I saw people time out, right? So it was definitely a testing your ability to move quickly, but also still control your fundamentals from the prone position, might I add. So that was an awesome stage. And I mean, I timed out for the first time. For those of you who don't know, Arizona is notorious for running 90-second stages. And this was no different. So I timed out on a stage. It was the very first stage of the day. You got to shoot off these rocks, and timed out after 7 hits. And I'm like, son of a bitch, is this how today is going to go? But, you know, I liked how the match really went full circle with, we're going to test you in every way that we can see possible. And it was good. You know, they had some stages where you're just laying prone, unlimited ammo. So you shoot 5 targets out and 5 targets back in, right? Hit to move on, unlimited, right? But if you're not seeing your miss, if you're not watching that trace, if you're not in a good position where your rifle will stay on target after the shot, then you just keep missing, right? So, I mean, it was pretty well run. When you think about Colorado, would you say that it was pretty well rounded? Or would you say that there was a kind of ongoing theme?
I think it's pretty well rounded. There was no like unsupported standing. There was no burpee stage this year. Well, I take that back. Actually, there was, but it wasn't like it has normally been in the past. So usually Colorado will have a stage where you are going to be shooting at that full-size IPSC at 300 or 400 yards, you know, offhand, and then you've got to get down into position on a barricade or prone, take a shot at a target, you know, and it's up, down, drill. They had that this year, but it was you could either start prone or start on the top of a barricade, which was a wooden pallet, you know, flipped up on its side and supported by 2 stakes.
Mm-hmm.
You started in position, you know, either on the pallet or on the prone, and then it was just one shot, and then you switch position, one shot, back and forth, up, down, up, down, up, down. But there was no unsupported standing like there traditionally has been. Quigley's match is my favorite match of the year, and I also think it is the most consistent match from year to year. If you've got a weakness, it's going to expose it. You know, there's some prone shooting, but it puts your body into a weird position.
Yeah.
It tests your ability to manage, you know, your bipod. There's a lot of, there's wide target transitions on a couple stages.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's got some good natural terrain to shoot out of. We're shooting out of trees. We're shooting off of rocks. You know, we're running down that little trench and grabbing positions on the left bank and the right bank, shooting off a dead tree, you know, like dead tree stumps. And then you've got, you know, a couple positions where you are in a good prone position, but the target is one MOA and it's silhouetted against the stage. And if you don't hit it, you're never going to see it.
Oh, yeah.
That's a pretty complete shooting test.
I'm trying to think what my favorite match would be. I don't even know if I have an answer. I think I just enjoy all of them. Yeah, I don't know. I would say, I'm thinking about the training aspect of it right now. And, you know, you got your fundamentals. We've talked about fundamentals in previous episodes and stuff like that. But there is one that comes to mind. I know that Russ was having issues at the match. He had texted me at the end of day one and said that he was having dope issues. And you had mentioned something earlier in the episode about, having confidence in your rifle, and, you know, you found out that it was you and not the gun. When I was in Montana, we got there a day early, check zero. And typically I don't like to check zero, but I did for whatever reason. I think I was feeling not so confident about the load that I have spun up at, you know, it was shooting tight ass groups. I can't complain about the groups that I was shooting at 100 yards, but I was running an SD of about 17. And you know, at distances where I was a little concerned. Now, the chronograph said I was shooting at 30-50 here in Las Vegas. I get up there to Montana. Chronograph, you know, when I'm zeroing, the chronograph is saying I'm shooting 29-70. And I'm like, where the fuck did 80 feet per second go? You know, like, is it the atmospherics? You know, what the hell is going on here? So right off the bat, there was some lack of trust and something was going wrong, right? So luckily they had a target out at like 1290 or something like that. So I dotted up for 1290, exactly what the ballistic calculator said, shooting 2970, what the chronograph said, and right over the target three times. Boom, boom, boom. So I'm like, well, son of a bitch. You know, I don't know what's happening right now, but let me put it back to 30-50, which is what I tested in Vegas. And look at that. First round impact after I changed the ballistic calculator. So I rolled with what I tested in Vegas, not what I got there in Montana. And, you know, I did fine. Fast forward, Arizona this past weekend, the very first stage, we had to shoot off some rocks for my first stage anyway. So all the targets are fresh, whitely painted targets right now, right? And I think I'm the first shooter. They said, Tyler, you're up first. I'm like, oh, perfect. Get down, first rock. I'm stable. I know I've got a good position. And it was a shark target. A little tiny bit of wind. I think I held left like 0.1 or something like that. Target wasn't that far. The first target anyway. I shoot. The round is right above my aiming point. And I'm like, okay, send a second round aiming the exact same spot. And I mean, it was a tight ass little group on that shark target, but it was 0.2 high. So I took that information, right? It was hot as hell in Arizona. I took that information and I started engaging the other targets, but I was subtracting 0.2 from my dope. And that's kind of what I wanted to bring up is when you're at these competitions, right? If you feel like you have something going on, right? Your ballistic calculator is not giving you the right dope. It's probably user error. But if you're zero, if you think your zero is off, right? Or I don't know, your ammo is hotter than normal, whatever the fucking case is, it doesn't mean that your entire match day is gone. It means that you need to recognize the pattern that is happening and make a correction instead of just continuously shooting over the fucking target. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
You know, like there is a...
I know exactly.
Yeah, there's a pattern happening. At some point, you have to say, you know what? I'm going to subtract 0.2 from all of my dopes and roll with it. And that's exactly what I did. For the rest of the day, every dope the calculator spit out, I just took 0.2 off. I was assuming that it was either... something happened where my zero was 0.2 high. Maybe it was the heat. Maybe it was the temperature outside, whatever the case it was. I was having some issues, but it worked, right? I saw a noticeable difference between changing my dopes from what the calculator said, and it worked. For the rest of the day, you know, unless I fucked it up, I was hitting what I was aiming at. So you have to be able to recognize those patterns when you see them and have the confidence to make the change. All right. Just don't keep shooting over the fucking target and say, oh, I'm going to check my dope or I'm going to check my zero at the end of day one. Like, I don't know. What are your feelings on that? If you go.
So it's funny. It's funny that you bring that up, man, because so I've had that happen to me and I have done exactly the opposite of what I should have done. I was having some dope issues at a match. And instead of just making the adjustment and doing whatever it fucking took to hit the target, I continued to run what the program was telling me. And every stage, I would just alter a number, you know, in either the gun profile or the ammunition profile, because my mind wanted to know what was happening in the phone. Like, why was I not getting the right information out of the phone? Because, you know, like I'm a little OCD like that. I want my stuff to be spot on. Like, I measure out my scope height to 1/100 of an inch, like that kind of stupid shit.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. Do whatever you need to do to get the hit on the plate and then figure it out afterwards.
I agree.
It's ironic that we're talking about this. On the way up to Colorado, I was listening to a podcast, the Modern Day Sniper one with Kalen and Phil, and Kalen's interviewing Ryan Kleckner, and he is talking about his, you know, prior military service and then the instructional stuff that he did after that, and he was saying the same thing. Like, you would watch students time and time again get balls deep into the electronics that they use and then send around downrange. That miss gives them a visual signature that they can easily use to make a correction and get a second round hit. But instead of doing that, they dive back into the electronics and spend the next 10 or 15 minutes trying to figure out what is going on before they come out and they put another shot on the plate, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Just make an adjustment and move on with your life. And then later on, at the hotel, at the bar, at dinner, whatever, then start screwing around with your electronics.
Well, but I was going
to don't do that out at the match. Like, just get your hits, man. Do whatever it takes to get your hits and move on with life.
I was going to say, if it's a 2-day match, in the first or second stage, I realize there is a problem and I fix it. I find a solution that is garnering me hits, right? Whatever I did, I added 0.2, I subtracted 0.2 from everything, whatever it is that I did, if it's working, I won't even change it that night.
No, just keep doing what you're doing.
Exactly. If it's a 2-day match, you just roll with that shit. And then at the end of the match, that's when you start to look at what went wrong. Was my zero off? Was the ammunition at a higher temperature than I'm normally used to shooting? Was there, you know, higher pressures? Higher humid environments create higher chamber pressure, so that you have issues there. You know, like all of these things start to take effect. But the time to figure it out is just like you said. It's not during the match. Find a solution to your problem, but then go back later and figure out what the root cause was. You know, after the match is over, shouldn't be changing your zero or anything like that. Once you find a solution, stick with it. Run with that shit. So
I've yet to go to a match and see somebody, you know, have issues, make a correction, and then move on with their life. And then at the end of the match, shoot well enough to like walk the table, but the MD say, well, you know, like you were 7th place, but your dope was screwed up, so we're going to put you down to 70th. Because you didn't shoot what the calculator told you, and if you would have shot what the calculator told you, you would have done worse. So your scores don't count. I've yet to see that.
Hell no.
All just get the hits.
Yeah, that's it.
I've yet to see. Yeah, you know, we won't go into that. Do what you need to do to get hits, man, and figure it out later.
100% agree. 100% agree. The last thing I'll talk about, because I know you got to get out of here pretty soon, is a buddy of mine. He's been through a few of my classes. He's been to Phil's classes. He's been all over the country doing different training events. And you know, his name is Brian. I saw him in Arizona. I squatted with him on purpose because I wanted to squad with him and watch how he performed, give him some advice, give him some tips, stuff like that. You know, anything I could do to help a guy out. And at the end of the match, he's like, no bullshit. Tell me, what did you see? And my biggest takeaway for him, and I'm sure this is true for a lot of shooters, right? It wasn't his fundamentals were bad, right? He had good positioning. He did a lot of things right, right? But the number one culprit that cost him points was that he was trying to beat the clock. So he would miss because he was trying to finish under time. If he would have slowed down, right? I can't tell you, Jeremy, at the Arizona match, there was a little bit of wind, but dude, it wasn't enough to have to come off of target for very many targets. Right? think there was like maybe two targets where you were holding off of the target for a wind call. Everything else was pretty straightforward because of how the wind was blowing that day.
Okay.
So when you're dealing with a situation like that, you have to look at a majority of your misses are coming from somewhere else. What does your sight picture look like? Oh, you're trying to move faster. You knew that the clock was ticking down on you, so you had to go faster. And by you going faster than you can shoot, you started to miss. And I tell everybody the same thing. But it takes experiencing that failure or that feeling to really hit home. But look at a majority of the matches. The winning percentage is somewhere in the 80% range, right? For a lot of them, it's 80%. That's 8 out of 10 on every stage. 70% or better get you in the top 10. So if you start looking at the stages and forgetting about the clock, forget that the timer is going. Just do your best to shoot. And if you miss, make a good correction, get on target, and accumulate as many points as you can as fast as your skill level will allow you to go. And I promise you, if you forget about the clock, you will instantly see your scores improve by 10 placements if you just forget that there's a clock and focus on getting ahead. Can you tell me I'm wrong?
No, I agree with you 100%, man. But that's also, so I see that with new shooters. That's very common. Everybody wants to go fast. I had it myself. I came from USPSA background. Like, how many times have you seen me time out ever?
Not a lot.
You can probably count it on one hand, right? Like, I love to shoot fast. So I get it. Everybody wants to go fast. But, you know, two slow hits are worth a whole lot more than 8 fast misses. And it just, you know, that's an experience thing. It's something that everybody has to go through. And kind of, you know, like, you could tell somebody till you're blue in the face, you need to slow down. But, you know, you can lead a horse to water. They don't always drink.
I agree.
But I agree. Like, slow down, see what you need to see, break a clean shot. Even if you only break 4 clean shots in 120 seconds, that's better than 8 or 9 dirty ones. You're not learning anything from those 8 or 9 shots that you took and missed. You're going to learn a whole lot more from the 4 that you took and hit.
I agree. 100%. 100%. So, yeah. And you got to look at every match as if it's also a practice session. You know, you want to practice doing the right things so that it becomes a habit, right? Because with more experience comes more speed. You find targets faster, you get on target faster, you can move faster, your body understands its natural point of aim, right? But if you're practicing, if every match that you go to, you're doing the wrong thing, I promise you it doesn't get better, right? You just keep getting faster at doing the wrong thing. So
gotta take your time.
But
with that being said, there is a time and a place for you to go past your comfort level.
Okay.
Like, once you have that mental maturity / experience under your belt to be able to throttle yourself when necessary, there is value in exceeding your speed limit just so that you know where that speed limit is at. I will do that, you know, at matches. I'll take a 4 out of 8 on a stage. If I set a goal like, hey, I want to move. If I'm working on movement, I want to shoot this stage within 40 seconds. I want to get 8 shots off within 40 seconds. Okay. You know, I'll take a 4 out of 8 there. And then my next goal will be to get a 5 out of 8 the next time and a 6 out of 8 the next time. So there are certain situations, you know, where I will accept a fast miss if I'm not super concerned with the speed. I'm not super concerned with the scoring. I'm more concerned with teaching myself how to move faster. But when all I'm concerned with is getting hits, like, slow hits better than fast miss.
Yeah, but I think the difference with what you're saying is that you're learning and understanding what went wrong. Whereas if you're just running the stage and you're trying to beat the clock and then you walk off and you say, damn, you know, damn, my score sucks, right? But you have no understanding of why it sucks. Then you didn't learn anything.
Oh, Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, you need to have that, you know, mental maturity and that experience to know why you're doing what you're doing.
Agreed.
If you're just up there running around, you know, like a loose cannon, shooting as fast as you possibly can, but not hitting shit, like, you need to take a step back and reevaluate what you are doing.
100%, dude. I agree with you. Well, hey, man, it's been an awesome time chatting with you. I think we've been on here a little over an hour and a half. I know you got shit to do. Shit, I got stuff to do. The podcast has been fun. I think it was pretty informative. Appreciate you taking the time out to chat with me. And
for sure, man. It's always a good time.
Yep. I am headed to Wyoming for a private class this weekend, but when I get back, we'll have some stuff to talk about, and look forward to catching up and talking about future stuff and some more how to do the thing that we do.
Sounds good, man.
All right, brother. Everybody else, appreciate you guys listening. Appreciate the support. I can't tell you enough how awesome it feels for people to come up and say that you guys enjoy the podcast and you feel like it's informative. We're going to keep pushing on. We'll try to keep up good content. And until next time, be safe, shoot straight. We'll catch you later.
See you guys.